All right. Now, can you hear this on the microphone?
Yes.
All right. Stick it in my pocket. How's that? Okay, good. That was all. Well, ladies, I don't know about you. I enjoyed myself last night. I had fun. It's always fun, you know, when you're doing the talk and you have fun doing it. I love this stuff, though, because I feel like it's helped me and it's helped my Christians in Singapore so much, so it's really fun to share it. I mean, I really feel like I have the most fun life and the most fun job. I enjoy what I do so much. I did start off last night sharing something that I learned years ago in a 12-step group, which was take what you like and leave the rest, because I know maybe a few of you weren't here last night, and spiritual healing for every person means something a little bit different. So what I say to you, to the audience, maybe won't apply to you. Don't take it personally, okay? But whatever does apply, hopefully that will help you and your friends. Tonight I would like to hopefully cover, for sure we're going to cover the schemas or life traps that I spoke about last night. We're going to cover them a little bit more in detail, and I want to show you some movie scenes that my husband and I think kind of help to illustrate that particular life trap. I can't do all 18, obviously, in a one-night talk, so I'm kind of highlighting the top five. And then I want to talk about what the concept of reframing means. I want to talk about forgiveness and the idea of how we can recover as a Christian from some of the different schemas that we have. I mean, the truth is we all have quite a few, so that's just life. So how do we work on those as a Christian, okay? Now, how many of you were here last night? Most of you. Okay, you know what? We'll just skip this. This is a cute little nappy clip, but most of you have seen it. If you haven't seen it, it's a cute Huggies commercial, but never mind. It's about don't worry, be happy. We talked about this last night as well. When our core needs are not met, mixed with our temperament and our environment, then we come out with life traps. And life traps are, you can go ahead, I'm just going to kind of go through this. We mentioned this last night as well, that these are the deeply entrenched beliefs that we have about ourselves and the world in which we live, that we get early in life. Broad themes, go ahead. We talked about the idea that you have maps and you get, you know, you're supposed to add new material and change your maps, but sometimes we get stuck and we don't change our maps, right? So we get stuck in these life traps. Okay? I should get one for England there. I didn't think to find an old map about England. Okay, go ahead. And then, we mentioned that last night as well. So now I'm going to show you some more, you know, like I said, some of the movie scenes. And first of all, this broad category here, disconnection and rejection, we have the life traps of abandonment, which you might guess, you know, happens normally when you are a child in a home where the parents split up. You don't always lose one of your parents, but frequently that is the case. And it might even happen in a home where your parents didn't split up, but maybe you had one parent that was very, you know, neglectful or was always gone, even for a good reason, perhaps, maybe ill or working. And so people can get that abandonment schema from that life trap. Mistrust and abuse, again, not too difficult to figure that one out. It can happen with physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse. Also, it doesn't have to just be from your parents. Again, like I said, I'm not trying to make the parents out to be the bad guy. Some kids maybe go to school and get abused by other kids at school. Severe bullying can cause mistrust and abuse. It might even happen if you had really nasty teachers. My husband went to school in Malaysia in quite a racist school environment. He was Indian, and he was in a school that was a Malay government school run by the, you know, the indigenous people of Malaysia. And in those days, they were extremely prejudiced against the Indians. Now, you know, you can look at it from their point of view. They were just making their new nation. They just got freedom from England or whatever. But still, you know, he got it. He said in his whole life he can count on one hand, until the time he was 15, he can count on one hand the days where he didn't get bullied by teachers at school. Of course, then he moved to an English boarding school. So he started a whole new kind of persecution. But anyway, emotional deprivation, that can be if you were emotionally deprived by your parents. And I think this is one of the most common ones in the world. Because how many of us actually had parents that met our emotional needs? You know, bless their hearts, most of them were just trying to put food on the table or take care of things or make sure we didn't flunk out of school or whatever. So it's actually only recently that parents have thought about meeting their kids' emotional needs. But sadly, that does cause us to have life traps. And so, and it also depends on how emotional you are as a person. If you're not a super emotional person, you might not feel emotionally deprived, even if your parents didn't talk to you much. But if you're a highly emotionally needy person, like many of us are, I certainly am like that, you know, then you're like, how come my parents don't talk to me? You know, I want to talk about my feelings. And so that's how I was as a teen. I had a family that protected me, that nurtured me, but they didn't really know how to show empathy to me as a teen. So I ended up feeling emotionally deprived, even though I had one of the nicest family lives probably in the whole world. Just one of those weird things. So, I would say, in a minute we'll talk a little bit more about this, but I would say, as a Christian, my needs have been met emotionally, and so when I did the inventory, I didn't even have a high score on this. Even though, when I thought about my past, I definitely was not emotionally connected to my parents. But that's where the kingdom can meet our needs, and we really can have friends in the church that meet those needs. But, you know, many, many people have emotional deprivation. It's extremely, extremely common. Defectiveness and shame. Defectiveness is also very common. And of the life traps, it's one of the ones that's... These, in fact, are kind of like primary life traps, and they can cause other life traps, which we'll talk about later. So, feeling defective. You know, if you have, for instance, either parents or siblings or teachers, again, significant others in your life, who are constantly telling you you're lousy, or you're fat, or you're ugly. You know, I remember a girl once that I studied the Bible with in Singapore. When I asked her about her family life, she started to cry. And I said, you know, what are you thinking about right now? This is way before I knew about counseling. And she said something like, I don't even know what I asked her, but somehow she started talking about her mother. And she said that every time she thought about her mother, she just remembered how her mother always called her ugly. And I was like, what kind of a mother calls her kid ugly? But actually, it happens a lot, sadly. But people grow up for different reasons. My husband, when he teaches about this, he'll tell everyone, you know, that he has the defectiveness life trap. But he's always been short. And he was made fun of for being short, especially in the English boarding school. And, you know, just different things when you're growing up can make you feel that way. In the Indian community that my husband's from, they tend to measure people on darkness of skin tone. And so he happens to be darker. Some of his brothers are more fair. So they were taught, oh, well, you know, desire to be fair. So, you know, different things over the years, it depends on your culture and what, like I say, you know, environment or whatever, things can make you feel defective. Social isolation is one where people feel that they never fit in. And there was a woman in our church who has literally struggled as a Christian as long as I've known her, probably 15 years at least. She has never, ever found a group at church in 15 years that she was happy with. She always complains about every group she's been in. She's the kind of person when someone suggests to a leader that she join that group, she's married, by the way, so her husband's actually a pretty, you know, decent chap, but when they want them as a couple to go to their group, the, you know, the people, the leaders will be like, no, please, no. You know, because they know when she comes, she's going to be there for a few weeks, and then she's going to hate their gods and tell all the things. So anyway, at the same time, you know, the Bible says love the weak. And so you want to find a way to help these people. Well, anyway, when we did this schema thing for our church, and she took the inventory that I talked about, she was as high as you could get on the score on social isolation. And she came to me afterwards and she said, I finally think I know what's wrong with me. And she had, you know, had a horrible childhood, not surprisingly. But remember in the old days when we used to go out evangelizing as a group? Now imagine if you have social isolation as a life trap.
Imagine how you feel when you have to go out and share your faith in public, right? And she would be petrified. And then she would do it, but she would hate everyone. So it was a little bit counterproductive for Christianity. And so, you know, but I mean, it was just so interesting. As she hit on that one thing, it was like her whole life made sense at that point. Now, it didn't mean she was healed or cured or whatever, and she'll probably, you know, she's a person who scored high on almost every schema, and she'll probably have to go in some kind of counseling herself. She wanted to wait a while just from some scheduling things in her life. But it was so cool to her to be able to think, oh, I know at least I'm not the most horrible Christian on earth. There's a reason that this stuff is difficult for me. Okay? Now, let's look at some movies. I'm going to be looking... did you guys ever see a film that came out in 1988 called Parenthood? For those of you that are my age, such a great movie. Such a great film. It's one of my all-time favorite films. It's a great film to show at a parent weekend for Christians. It generates tons of discussion. Every single life trap is exhibited in that show. It's a blast. It's such a cool movie. But anyway, there's one of the characters... played by the actress name, I think Diane Wiest is how she says it. And the guy, the little kid in here, don't get distracted when you look at him, but that's Joaquin Phoenix, the guy that played Gladiator and, you know that guy? What else? Village. He's been in a few movies. Yeah, Joaquin. We've known him as an adult. He's in here as a 13-year-old. So, very, very good actor, even as a child. But anyway, this movie is, I won't tell you the whole parts of the movie, but the part that we're interested in is this character, this lady. Her husband has deserted her after she already had two kids. He's deserted her for a younger woman and gotten a new family. Even though they live in the same town, he doesn't visit his children. And so the son is 13 and he's starting to feel it. So that's what we're going to see now, and then we'll talk a little bit more about that later.
You ready, Gary? You want anything to eat? How long are they going to be living here?
Not much longer, I think.
Well, I was just thinking. It's getting pretty crowded here.
Oh, it's not so crowded. There's a lot more room since they shaved their heads.
His sister just got married as a high school student.
Maybe I could stay with Dad for a while. Well, I've been here a long time. Maybe I should live with him for a while.
You want to live with your father?
Kind of.
Have you talked to your father about that?
No, not yet. I thought I'd call him.
Honey? You know, you don't know your father like I do.
I don't know him at all. What's his number?
Well, he'd be at work now. So that's 206-5790.
Yeah, it's Dr. Lampkin there. His son. No, Dad, it's not Joey. It's Gary, your other son. Well, I need to ask you something. It'll just take a second. Well, would it be okay if I stay with you for a while? A few months? Okay. Shit. Mm. You didn't think it was such a good idea.
Oh, sweetie. I gotta go.
Didn't that just rip your heart out? Now, we'll show another clip to see what that ends up, you know, what direction he goes. This is his father's dental office. So, you can see, even just from that little scene, you know, how sad the abandonment life trap is. And obviously tonight when we watch some of these scenes, I'm sure, I mean, you know, I didn't even have that kind of background, but just watching it makes me cry, and I've seen it before. So, it won't be surprising if obviously you've had a difficult time, or you're friends with people that have, that you would, you know, that these things can make you emotional. Think about the different kinds of life traps he could get, though, just from what we saw in that little tiny scene. The abandonment, the mistrust and abuse, the emotional deprivation, the feeling of defectiveness. You know, my dad loves his other son, not me. And then the social isolation and alienation. It's like everything is right there. So these are the most common ones in the world, by the way, when they do therapy, and that's why these are listed as the first five in Dr. Young's research. But these are very real, and a lot of people, you know, have these issues. So imagine if you've had, let's just say, looking at it from a Christian point of view, and let's say you have felt bad about yourself as a person. Like, let's say you have defectiveness for whatever reason, and you feel bad about yourself as a person. Then you become a Christian, and you feel excited that God loves you, and then you start getting discipled. Now, discipling literally means helping someone to be like Jesus.
Amen.
That's all it means. It's not a bad word. I actually believe in discipling 100%. The problem is the way we disciple. So, if you happen to have a discipler who is a, what we might call a good people person, who has empathy, who listens well, and who knows how to take care of you when you're feeling bad about yourself, and how to show you the difference, like we said last night, how to put those positive glasses on when you read the Bible and all that, you'll actually love discipling. And it will help you to get over your defectiveness schema. I'm not joking. It does. However, if you have someone that's perhaps insensitive and just thinks you should repent and get on with it, or something like that, right, which some of us ourselves have been guilty of doing and saying to people, then if you have defectiveness schema, you might not respond so well to the discipling. Now, we're going to talk a little bit later about how we cope with our life traps. But I'll just give you a little preview. The main three ways that we cope, and you've heard this before if you've done any psychology, fight, flight, or fright, right? The three Fs. So in schema language, they say that you respond by counterattack. That's the fight. You respond by escape. That's the flight, or you respond by surrender. That's the fright. So, if you think about the way people even responded to discipling, sometimes the counterattack came out. Some people respond by the counterattack. You challenge me, well, let me tell you what I think about you. Okay? Sometimes the escape right? Maybe, like we talked about last night, how you can run away to a hobby or a job or a boyfriend or anything, computers, eating, drinking even, smoking, whatever, even things we know we're not supposed to do, but we can escape the bad feelings we're having about ourselves and not even understand that. Or fright, surrender, we just surrender. We don't do anything. We're immobile. Okay? So think about these things as you think about maybe, you know, the spiritual healing you want to go through and how you'll reverse that. All right, let's look at the next series. These are some the life traps that are under this little heading of impaired autonomy and performance. So we didn't talk about this too much last night, but it's because I've got a longer video clip. The dependence life trap, you know, again, all of these are in your brochure, which you may have read last night or looked at a little bit. So I'm not going to, you know, again, describe it too much in detail. But dependence is caused a lot of times by parents who constantly tell you that you can't do something yourself, so you end up being dependent on them. All right? Vulnerability is where you constantly think that you're vulnerable to an illness or to something bad happening to you. So, for instance, I have a friend whose father is always convinced he's got the newest kind of cancer or whatever, heart, you know, something. But then his son is exactly the same. So my friend, who's about 35 years old and a successful lawyer and one of the richer people in our congregation and very well known, very well liked, very popular guy, handsome. In fact, he used to be a bodybuilder and he was Mr. Asia. So, you know, you can imagine this guy is like well-rounded as anything, right? Just an incredible guy, talented in every area, and spiritual. He's a Bible talk leader, loves God, stood up to his parents and changed religions. You know, his parents were from a non-Christian Asian religion. But can you imagine he has this vulnerability schema? So if he just gets the slightest cough, he thinks he has throat cancer, and he never even smoked. You know, I mean, we laugh, but seriously, right? Just a little crick in the neck, and then he's, you know, probably got broken something or whatever. But it's because in growing up, when the slightest thing would happen, the mother would be, you know, all out of proportion with the dad, and then again with him. And so he learned through time to develop that vulnerability. Enmeshment is where it's called undeveloped self. This is where children, for whatever reason, are so attached to the parents, they just can't break through and be themselves. And you see this a lot with kids who won't leave home, or when they finally do leave home, they're talking on the phone constantly to their parents. I mean, nothing against being connected to your parents. I'm not against that at all. But people who can't make a decision without talking to their parents, you know, when they're already in their 20s or something like that, that's known as enmeshment. And then lastly, the sense of failure. The reason this is a little bit different than defectiveness has to deal with how you feel about yourself as a whole, you in the inside. Failure is specifically related to your performance. So it's like you constantly look down on yourself, how you perform, perhaps in school or work. That's what that's related to. Now we're going to see, and this one is definitely a parenting clip. It's more something that we would use to show parents about how to not cause this in their child. But it's also a cute thing to watch. So we're just going to see a little bit of this.
Where did everybody go?
It's a bit sad.
Corey, get inside the house, Corey. Corey, don't. You'll be fine. Just get inside. You, right there. Coral.
5 more minutes.
No, do that, me.
Okay.
Get up.
Time for school.
Boy,
Nemo.
Where's the damn school?
Nemo, don't move. You'll never get out of here. I'll do it. All right, where's the break? You feel a break?
No.
Sometimes you can't tell because fluid is rushing into the area. Now, any rushing fluids?
No.
Are you woozy?
No.
How many stripes do I have?
Three.
Answer the stripe question.
Three.
No! See, something's wrong with you. I have one, two, three. That's all I have. Oh, you're okay. How's the lucky fin?
Lucky.
Let's see. Are you sure you want to go to school this year? Because there's no problem if you don't. You can wait 5 or 6 years.
Come on, Dad. Time for school.
Forgot to brush.
Oh.
Do you want this anemone to sting you?
Yes.
Brush.
Okay, I'm done.
Oh, you missed a spot.
There.
We're excited. First day of school, here we go. We're ready to learn to get some knowledge. Now, what's the one thing we have to remember about the ocean?
It's not safe.
That's my boy. So, first, we check to see that the coast is clear. We go out and back in. And then we go out and back in. And then one more time, out and back in. And sometimes, if you want to do it 4 times,
yeah.
All right, come on, boy.
Dad, remember when we were in the school? I was getting sharp.
I highly doubt that.
Did you ever met a shark?
No, and I don't plan to.
How are those sea turtles?
Sea turtles? I don't know.
Didn't your acquaintance from next door? He said that sea turtles they live together at 100 years old.
Well, you know what? If I ever meet a sea turtle, I'll ask her. After I'm done talking to the shark, okay? Hold on. Wait to cross. Hold my fin.
Dad, you're not going to freak out like you did at the petting zoo, are you?
You're not going to freak out like you did at the petting zoo. Isn't that sweet? I love that clip. Finding Nemo. Now, honestly, didn't he have a good reason to be that way? He saw his wife get eaten by a barracuda. If you saw your husband get eaten by a barracuda, you'd probably be scared too. Okay? So one of the things about life traps is, you got to remember, there's a lot of good reasons why we develop them. If you got abandoned as a kid, is it your fault you have abandonment schema? If you have if you've been abused, is there any surprise if you have mistrust and abuse? No. So this, to me, when I look at these things, I think, wow, there's a perfectly good reason for many of these things. Now, that doesn't mean we should just do nothing about it. Okay? That's why God made the church, I believe. And we'll talk even more later about that. But you can see why the dad was that way. Now, if he had a child with a different personality, he may have made a child that was completely scared to death. Right? You can imagine that happening. So what did he say about the first lesson you should learn? It's not safe. You know, honestly, if you're getting your kid to school, you don't want them to think the very first lesson to learn in going to school is it's not safe. That's actually not a good thing to teach your kid. You don't want him to just go with anybody, but you don't want him to think about in life everything is unsafe. So you can see how, you know, this kind of thing happens, and how we develop these different life traps. All right, let's go to the next section. Impaired limits. Now these are fun to watch. I put the more intense one first, and then we'll end with the funnier one. But we'll first watch one about... I think these are both funny. Okay. Anyway, I think the first one is the insufficient self-control, if I'm not mistaken. And this one is actually from a Bollywood film. It came out in England a few years ago and was a top seller. I mean, obviously, it came out in India first. It was called Kabhi Khushi Kabhi Gham. And some of you may have seen it. And it stars the extremely famous Shah Rukh Khan. He's probably the most famous actor on the planet if you count the number of people that follow him. So he's the heartthrob of Bollywood movies. So anyway, we're going to learn about insufficient self-control. And then after that, we'll see another one about entitlement.
Out, come on, yes! School le jana,
thank you. Score kya hua?
104.6, is that great?
Damn good, yeah. Kitne hua sir?
We got them!
Yes!
I think India is going to kill me!
Last minute pe kuch bhi ho sakta hai. India ka koi bharosa nahi. You never know with India, Rohan.
No.
Thank you, Sajan. Sajan, we're winning. Yes. We got them.
Yes. Aliens were 1947 mein out ho hi gayi thi.
PJ. That was a PJ.
Oh. Allah, 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 Allah. Ye pao hai ki
kya? Kya, Sajan? Ye abhi bhi apne shoelace bana nahi sikha?
To kya hua? Chote sa bachcha hai,
Sajan. Arre, aap ise karne nahi doge to seekhega kaise motu?
Jani se wapas kyun aaya?
Jani, kya ho raha hai yahan?
Kya maa, aapne is Rohan ko khila khila ke kaddu bana liya.
Haan, hasu. Jab main boarding school chala jaunga na, tab yaad karna mujhe. Nobody loves.
Now, wasn't that classic? And, you know, Nadine Templer, who has lived in India for many years of her life, when I just was speaking to her recently, she said that, unfortunately, you know how they have that dowry system? Where they, if you have a daughter, then you have to save tons of money to pay. So they have a lot of those, like, abortion clinics where they kill the baby if it's a girl. And so they have more boys than girls, which is bizarre. But then, on top of that, she said they spoil the boys rotten, especially the firstborn. So you're actually getting this phenomenon. She said it's like they're breeding the insufficient self-control and the entitlement, unfortunately, right now in India, in the new young people. She said it's like a whole new wave. And then, you know, she said the women are tough as nails, but then these guys are like, oh my goodness. So, now, how many of you saw the old Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory? Not the Johnny Depp, but the old one, okay? You'll recognize this is a great case of entitlement. How to raise a narcissist.
I know, Angel. We're doing the best we can. I've got every girl on the bleeding staff hunting for you.
All right, where is it? Why haven't they found it?
Veruca, sweetheart, I'm not a magician. Give me time.
I want it now. What's the matter with those twats down there?
For 5 days now, the entire flipping factory's been on the job. They haven't shelled a peanut in there since Monday. They've been shelling flaming chocolate bars from dawn to dusk.
Make a white night.
Come along, you girls, put a jerk in it, or you'll be out in your ears, every one of you. And listen to this, the first girl that finds a golden ticket gets a £1 bonus in the pay packet. What do you think of that?
Not even trying. They don't want to find it. They're jealous of me.
Sweetheart, I can't push them no harder. 19,000 bars an hour they're shelling. 760,000 have done so far.
You promised, Daddy. You promised I'd have it the very first day.
You're going to be very unpopular around here, Henry, if you don't deliver soon.
I hate to see her unhappy.
I won't talk to you ever again. You're a rotten, mean father. You'll never give me anything I want. and I won't go to school till I have it.
Veruca, sweetheart, angel. There are only four tickets left in the whole world, and the whole ruddy world's hunting for them. What can I do?
Happiness is what counts for children. Happiness and harmony.
That one kills me. Oh, that's so funny. Now, in Singapore, one of the guys that helps me with the movie therapy stuff, his name is Ling Pin. He's a great guy. He was a commando in the military for years as a full-time job. Big guy, very strong, very no-nonsense. He came from a difficult family. His mother died of cancer when he was young, and he and his dad didn't speak for years. And so he was helping me cut these clips out for my presentation. And when he saw that one, he was like, one slap. So, I think it's fairly obvious the way they do that one, right? You don't really have to explain that one. But if you think about it, though, we've all known people who act that way. Very demanding, only think of their own needs, no empathy for anyone else. And sadly, some of you probably have parents that are like that, and you may have suffered at the hand of a parent like that. And there's books you can read if you had narcissistic parents that actually help you to heal as a person. In the ICOC, there was a certain group of leaders that had those tendencies who thought that it was great to have leaders like that. But I want you to think about this though. It's not just in the ICOC. Every group gets fascinated by people like this. When John and I were doing our masters in counseling, one of the lecturers, he's a professor in a university in a city in Australia. I don't want to say which one because I don't want to, say too much about this guy's life. But really cool professor, very knowledgeable, very helpful. But as we were talking to him, he found out that John and I also led a church besides doing this course. And then he confided to us after the class that he doesn't like to say it when he's teaching, he said, but he's actually on the board of the Church of England for Australia. So he's, quite high up in the religious world in a profession where quite often people are not, Christian-oriented or have any kind of religion. So he was chatting with us about different things. Then that was the first night. Then the next day, when he was trying to give an illustration about ethics, he was lecturing us on ethics and confidentiality the second day. When he was doing that, then he started telling this story. And he was trying to tell it without using any specifics, and finally he said, oh, bag it, I just have to tell you the story the way it happened. So basically what happened was, there was a congregation of, I don't know if it's called Church of England in Australia, to be honest, but whatever it's called, whatever church that is. But there was this congregation that had quite huge congregation. And the leader of that congregation, he felt, based on some things that he heard from people that were in that congregation, he felt like the guy was an extremely entitled person, to the point where he felt he had narcissistic personality disorder. But he only felt that because of what some of the people in the congregation had told him. He himself didn't know that guy and didn't go to that congregation. So he decided to recommend, just so that he could have a clear conscience, he decided to recommend that that guy be assessed by a psychologist. Not by him, because he already knew some of the facts and he didn't want to be colored by his, idea. But he just recommended it. And that the reason he was teaching this in the ethics part was that guy got mad at him and said, oh, that was a breach of confidentiality. He said, no, I've never counseled you. I didn't do anything wrong, and I'm also serving on the board of this group, this denomination, so I have to look out for their interests. So then, sure enough, he was assessed, and sure enough, he was, completely found to have them. So it just so happens that people that have the entitlement life trap often are very charming. And so if you don't have to live with them or work very closely with them, you might get on really well with them. Now, sometimes they come across just horribly. Like, did you see The Devil Wears Prada? Okay, so that character that Meryl Streep played, she's obviously someone who is very entitled. Now, you also would see her sometimes in the quiet scenes. She also probably had the defective schema too, right? And she would cry and feel sad about her life. But in general, she was very extremely, you know, in your face, you do what I say, and she looked down on anyone who didn't do what she said, and she had no empathy for anyone else's schedule. So that's kind of what goes along with entitlement. A very interesting characteristic of it is that the inability to have empathy. So I'm going to tell you this, if you're a parent, try to develop empathy in your kids. If you see that they don't have empathy, try to develop that. Because it does prevent, it's like giving them an inoculation against entitlement. That's why if you were here last night and you heard my story about Sonia and the taxi driver, that's why I freaked out, because I don't want my kids to not have empathy. Sorry about the double negative. Anyway, the insufficient self-control, that's the one I shared, you know, has always been mine. I was the kind of kid who always did my homework at the last minute. When John and I did our master's together, he would do the paper and finish it 2 weeks early. And I would be lucky if I finished it 2 hours early. Seriously, I'd be like typing the last page and printing it and then driving it in and handing it in at the deadline. So I got better as the course went by because I was inspired by my husband. I think I finally made it 2 days early one time. But he would always do it 2 weeks early, you know. Then he'd get really ticked off if I made the same grade he did. He was like, oh. He did usually beat me. He was quite competitive. He would compare with the other three of us, and he would always look to see if he got the better grade. He has the unrelenting high standard. We'll talk about that later. See, I can slander him because he's not here. No, he's awesome, obviously. I'm just kidding. But, yeah, but with the insufficient self-control, my mom is just the same way. So she's very laid back. I did not grow up, you know, with much of a deadline. We lived on a farm. And my mom would wake me up in the mornings, come in very sweetly into the room. Honey, time to get up. And she'd come in 3 or 4 times, you know. So I never had to get up with an alarm. I just didn't learn discipline. And I don't at all blame my mother, by the way. I know it's completely my sinful nature. I hate discipline. But I'm just saying, it ends up, in hindsight, I think of, and I don't mean this towards my parents, I just say, wow, if there's anything I wish they had done differently is if, because my dad's really disciplined. I thought, you know, wouldn't that have been nice if I could have got some of his discipline? So it's not like I think that they did a bad job or something, I think they did their best, but I'm just saying, you know, looking back, I think, whoa, that's one thing I could have benefited from if I had learned to be more disciplined. So with our kids, John obviously is way more, you know, so much more disciplined than me. And so we try to do that with our children. So for yourself, if you find that you struggle with discipline, then, obviously all of us from time to time have struggled with discipline. But it may be that this is a life trap you have. And it's not as difficult to overcome as you think. I make fun of myself for having this life trap, but compared to how I was 20, 25 years ago, I'm actually extremely disciplined. I just kind of compare myself sometimes to people that I know that are all like hyper-disciplined, like, and even Singapore as a nation, you know, is kind of hyper-disciplined. So I stand out as not being too disciplined just because I'm not Singaporean. But I think, you know, that can also be a strength. To not be too rigid. So it's kind of a, you know, it's a little bit of a blessing and a curse. But I think you can see that, I just want you to see that all of us are different, and in the past you might have looked down on someone that was different than you, but then, you know, if they were an entitled person, a very bossy, charming person that irritated you or you felt like manipulated you or something, it's very likely they may have had parents that just indulged them all the time. And so, in a way, they were destined to become that way. Now, I'm not saying they should be you know, allowed to be that way as a Christian without ever changing. You hope that they would change. But in just the same way that we all need grace for our life traps, even people that are entitled actually need grace. It's kind of a funny thing, but I mean, Jesus even gave grace to the Pharisees. So we have to think about that. All right, let's look at this idea of others' directedness. In church, I find this one is extremely, I would say, extremely prevalent. Many of us at church are self-sacrificing. And it's not necessarily bad. It's not bad to give yourself for other people. Jesus says that that's good. But when it becomes a problem is when we do it so much that we hurt ourselves. So it's only a maladaptive schema or a painful life trap if we are so self-sacrificing that we do it to the point of hurting ourselves. And some of us had to learn that the hard way. We'll show a little thing, a little clip about it, and then I'll share some more about that. I think we're going to look at a clip about self-sacrificing first, and then we'll look at subjugation after that.
Tell me what you want as fast as it comes to.
This is a movie about a guy who's got a mentally retarded brother and a mother who weighs about 700 pounds.
Faster.
Okay. I want a new thing. House. I want a new house. For the family. I want Mama to take aerobics classes. I want Ellen to grow up. I want a new brain for Arnie.
What do you want for you? Just for you.
I want to be a good person. I can't do this.
Here she is. She's his new friend that he's just made, and she wants him to think about himself, because as a teenager, he spends his entire life thinking about everyone else. And then, even in the middle of doing that exercise, all of a sudden he's like, oh no, where's my brother? Because he literally is his brother's keeper, because his mother weighs 700 pounds and can't move off the couch. And so it's quite a good movie, very kind of a touching movie. But that's how self-sacrificing develops. Someone was sharing with me, just since I've been here, someone was telling me about taking care of their parents when their parents were ill when they were young or something. I can't remember the story they told, but or maybe I think they were saying they always wanted to keep peace in the family. So from 6 years old, they just knew, I've got to make everyone happy. So, you know, then people in that situation, you develop self-sacrifice. What happens is usually people that do have the self-sacrificing life trap eventually do get what? Burned out. And then you feel like, oh no, why did I do all that? Who's doing anything for me? And so that's why it's important to understand that balance. Okay, so, but it's never wrong to be a sacrificial person because Jesus was sacrificial. So you don't want to confuse the two. You know, it's not like you want to say, okay, good, then I'll be selfish. Obviously, that's completely not Christ-like. But it's having the right spirit about it and knowing how to draw that boundary. All right, now we're going to look at a scene from a movie called Stuart Saves His Family. I don't want to start it just yet, so just hang on one second. So this is a movie. It's actually supposed to be a comedy. It's made by the people that do Saturday Night Live. However, it's a very sweet movie. So I don't know. I didn't watch Saturday Night Live for years because I was living in Asia and they didn't have it. So apparently this was like a stock character that they made fun of every week. But then he got so popular that they made a movie about him. So it's called Stuart Saves His Family. And he's a guy who talks with a lisp, and he's always going to 12-step meetings. He's in every 12-step group ever invented, and he's got every addiction possible. And he's always trying to figure out how to, you know, fill up those voids in his life. But basically, he's telling the story now. What we're going to hear him narrating is part of the story of why he became the kind of person who always wants to save his family. Okay?
The Smalleys were never very good with money. My father grew up in the Great Depression. His mother. And there never was much when we were kids. And for some reason, I was always looking for a way to bail the family out.
May the Lord always watch over you.
Good night, everybody.
Wow, a car full of cash.
Whose is it?
Nobody's yet. It's first prize, the Ajax sweepstakes.
Look at all that money.
How do you enter?
Easy. Help name the Ajax White Knight.
They got 1,000 prizes. Come on, folks, not stand back.
Enter the Ajax sweepstakes. Help name the White Knight. And you may ride off with a fortune. Three
sweepstakes.
Where you buy Ajax laundry detergent.
No samples, ma'am. You want to win, get an entry blank.
In case of tie, winner will be determined by earliest postmark.
I was convinced I had the perfect name and got to the post office at exactly 9 a.m. the next morning.
You've already sent it in?
Mm-hmm.
I just don't want you to be horribly crushed when you don't win. What was your name again?
Sir Cleanlot.
I don't know why. I can't remember that.
It's the Ajax White Knight. He cleans, you know, a lot.
I don't know.
When the big night finally arrived, Dad had a new nickname for me.
Here we go. Is Sir Eat-A-Lot getting a little nervous?
I was already nostalgic for Waste of Space.
Now we're to my friends at Colgate-Palmolive.
At about 8:57, my heart was pounding, and I was trying to block my family out of my consciousness and pray that the name would Sir Clean-A-Lot.
6 weeks ago tonight, we announced the name, the Ajax White Knight Contest. Well, 2 million entries later, we have a winner.
This is it. Sir Eat-A-Lot's moan of triumph.
The winner of the name, the Ajax White Knight Contest, and the winner of a brand new 1967 Pontiac Bonneville filled with cash is... Mrs. Carl Hesby of Council Bluffs, Iowa.
There must be some mistake, Stuart. You can't be Mrs. Carl Hesby, can you?
And the name submitted by Mrs. Hesby, the name of the Ajax White Knight is... Sir Lancelot.
Lancelot?
That is a better name.
Congratulations, Mrs. Hesby. You're a creative woman. Your family must be very proud.
Aww. And as you watch the movie, his dad is like a real fruitcake. And he gets worse and worse. It's kind of sad, but it has a happy end. As most movies do. So, you know, that's why I said yesterday dysfunction is the gift that keeps on giving, right? So, example of Stuart, he wasn't able to be assertive as an adult after, you know, growing up like that. He had the escape mode that I mentioned earlier, and he went into all those different addictions. He constantly tried to rescue his family, and then he himself, if you watch the whole movie, you find that he only had a happy ending when he finally learned how to say no. People that have subjugation feel that they have no choice. So, for instance, I used to be a subjugated person, and I can honestly say through some discipling and also through a lot of my own reading and through the counseling and through working things through with my husband, I have learned to not be subjugated. Now, I will still refer to myself as a subjugated type person, but my husband will quickly interrupt and say, no, you are not subjugated. Don't say you're subjugated, because I fight with him all the time. So he's like, you don't let me get away with anything. How dare you say you're subjugated? But it is my tendency. I hate conflict. And I've been called a conflict avoider and a people pleaser. Any of you recognize that? But I didn't realize that it was actually, you know, in a way, something that has developed in me through my life. Now, looking back, I remember my mom was the exact same way. And my dad was the kind of guy who, when he said it, that was it. It was final, and you don't argue. And my mother would always back down and let him win. I never saw them fight in my entire life. Literally, never saw my parents have one fight. Now, I saw sometimes maybe she might question a slight amount, but literally, you know, in my whole life, never saw them have a fight. Now she's gotten older, and as most of us subjugated types do when we hit a certain age, we say, life is too short to be subjugated, and we throw off the subjugation, and we might come out with our fangs. That also, I believe, is part of what happened in 2003. As many of us as Christians had been subjugated, but unfortunately, when we decided to not be subjugated anymore, we came out with fangs. And that's not very Christ-like either. So it's terrible to be subjugated, but it's also terrible to then counterattack and attack with fangs and claws. Now, if you're in a marriage with a person who's dominating you and maybe an entitled person, as we saw earlier, and you are subjugated, you can bet that you'll be miserable. It happens all the time. I mean, in marriage counseling, this is one of the classic things. And my husband is a very, you know, strong guy. And so for years, I thought it was right for me to just not have any conflict with him. You know, and I really did think being submissive meant just to give in and be quiet. But that's not, you know, I am a highly opinionated person, but I'm also such a conflict avoider, it wasn't really hard for me to do that. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like so tricky for me to do that as it might be for some people. But then, sometimes it would go against my conscience. And I'd want to bring things up. But then I'd be conflicted. If I bring that up, am I not being submissive? Should I be quiet now? You know what I mean? Those questions. And so I think what I found was, I had to feel like I had a clear conscience. So I remember one time I was bringing something up to John, and he said, why do you think you have to say that? And I said, I have to say it in order to have a clear conscience. And he said, no. I said, if I don't say it, it will hurt my conscience. And he said, well, why doesn't it hurt your conscience to not be submissive to your husband? Which I thought, no, that's interesting. He has a point on that one. But I said, well, sorry, that one doesn't hurt my conscience as much. But, you know, I'm grateful for all that. And I know John is, because he has said since then many, many times, he has in public said it out loud to many people that, you know, praise God, he's very grateful for the input that I've, you know, given him. And he always says, I've given him more input than anyone else on earth. So I don't think there's anything, you know, wrong with that part. And we have a great relationship. We're a good partnership because we're complete opposites. And we just had our anniversary. In fact, yesterday was our 21st anniversary. So we've been sending each other e-cards and trying to be romantic on the computer, which doesn't work very well. But we'll have a little mini retreat in Kiev next week. It's okay. But anyway, I think that me learning about how to not be subjugated has really helped our marriage. Because I mean, I'm always my real self. I'm not hiding behind anything. I'm not afraid of the conflict. I still get a little pit in my stomach. I get physical symptoms with conflict. I don't know if any of you can relate. I get sick at my stomach. This is kind of gross, but I actually sweat a lot. And I will literally have to take several showers if I'm in a conflict situation. I'll literally have to take several showers that day. But it's one of those things. It still brings up a physical response, but I can overcome it. So if you feel that some of your, you know, pain in the past was from subjugation, you know, God doesn't want you to be the kind of person who just swallows bitterness, as the Chinese say. You know, God never says that in the Bible. And usually that's not really taught. Now, there were some people who said, submit to your leader and do whatever they say. But honestly speaking, most people knew that that wasn't right. It's just sometimes is the easier thing to do. You know, and I've talked to different people that felt subjugated and resented leaders for it. But then later, when they got more clarity, they said, you know, the truth is, I could have done things. But I just didn't. Okay? So that's where subjugation causes a problem. Now let's, I think I have one, do I have another clip about that? Can you just go for it? I was just going to say about the self-sacrifice, but I think I already talked about that enough. Approval seeking is related, so I didn't put a clicker in for that. All right, let's go to the next series. Overvigilance and inhibition. Now, this one, a lot of people mentioned last night, they could relate to these. Negativity, pessimism. Emotional inhibition, unrelenting standards, hypercriticalness, and punitiveness. This right here, if you were to live in Singapore and grow up in Singapore, these are the national life traps of Singapore right here. The whole nation is like this. The city was built on unrelenting standards. How do you think it went from being a backwater place 40 years ago to now being one of the top cities in the world? Did any of you happen to catch that F1 race on TV recently? Can you imagine what Singapore looks like? And 40 years ago, it was the pits. It was a den of malaria. You know, and now they're saying it's the nicest city to have the F1 in the whole world. I didn't even watch it. I don't even know what F1 is. Most Singaporeans, by the way, most Singaporeans don't know what F1 is. They were making fun of themselves in the newspaper. They did like a mock interview. The guy's got the camera. It's a little cartoon. And he says, you know, to this man on the street, he's obviously asked, what is F1? And the Singaporean guy goes, I think it's the key between escape and F2. But our motto in Singapore is, nerds rule the world. Awesome city. But no, seriously, the whole country is built on these things. So if you have any of these, you can feel very at home in Singapore. Praise God. I don't have any of these. Amen. But almost my entire church, almost, not all, but almost my entire church has these four. If not all four, they have at least three or two of them. But it's very normal to be negative. When I first moved to Singapore, and I lived there about a year, there was a sister who was a Singaporean. She was the first Singaporean conversion to become a Bible Talk leader. And she was, in fact, the first Singaporean conversion that we had that went on staff. She was about maybe a year old as a Christian when she went on staff. And, of course, in those days, everybody there was a young Christian. So John's youngest brother was quite a bit younger. John was 26, and his brother was 10. And so he came and lived with us and went to school in Singapore. That's kind of an Asian thing to do, you know, whoever's in the place where the best school is, they send the siblings there. So he was staying with us. He came home from school one day, walked in the door when I was having a little staff meeting, but I think we were having a break or something, and he said, I said, hey, how was school today? And he kind of looked shy, and he said, well, I made a 91 on my math test. And I said, wow, 91, that's fantastic. And the other girls were sitting there, you know, drinking tea or whatever. So I said, hey, you made 91 on this. Isn't that cool? And they were like, yeah. Then he went in the other room, and you know, to get a drink and do whatever. So anyway, I sat back down. And then this sister I just mentioned, the young Christian, her name is Pat, she looked at me and she said, wow, Elgin is so lucky to have you for a sister-in-law. And I said, why? And she said, because you're so encouraging. And I said, what did I do that was encouraging? And she said, the way you talked to him just now. I said, well, he made a 91 on his math test. What else do you say when someone makes a 91 on his math test? And she said, well, that's not what my parents would have said if I made a 91 on a math test. I'd only lived there about a year, and I hadn't been with many parents, so I had no clue what she meant. And I said, you know, what would they say? And she said, the first thing they would say is, how many other people made a 91? And the second thing they would say, when they got home, they would take my paper, look through to see where the red marks were, and tell me how stupid I was for making such a silly mistake, and I could have made a higher mark if I just hadn't been so stupid. Now, when she said that, I finally understood my church. I was like, oh, no wonder everyone is a perfectionist here. I hadn't quite got it yet, you know. But that's how, that's the culture. That's how they're brought up. I mean, 91 on a math test, right? And so it can obviously create a lot of insecurity in people. In fact, the reason these are at the end of the list, 15, 16, 17, 18, is because these are more secondary. You usually get these as a result of having the other ones. So, for instance, you can have defectiveness and not have unrelenting standards, but if you have unrelenting standards, you definitely have defectiveness, because defectiveness is what produces it. So you feel defective, so guess what you want to do? Be the best. Okay? Some of you are laughing. I know. And you know, a lot of great leaders are like this. Are you surprised? Right? My husband has all four of these, and he laughs about it, and he knows he does. A lot of these things are what make you sharp as a leader. Can you imagine me with my insufficient self-control, so I'm mischievous? If I wasn't married to John Louis, I don't even think I would have done anything in my whole life. I'd be a very happy person, very sweet, and have a lot of friends. But I happen to be married to someone who has unrelenting standards and who has great, not just great dreams. I can have a lot of great dreams, but he actually does something, right? I'm the one that read the book on movie therapy, and I said, oh, what a nice thing, and I put it away. John was like, we're going to start one in Singapore. So, you know, it's not that these things are so terrible, right? It's just that if they're ruling our life, it can make us miserable. And of course, if you happen to be with a leader who is ruled by these things, it might make you miserable. And they don't mean anything bad by it. They're trying to help you. So sometimes when my husband's unrelenting standards get a little bit on the annoying side, we have our ways of, you know, what would I say? We have our ways of trying to turn it into a humorous situation. Because no one wants to feel like they're put in that kind of pressure cooker. The people that have them, that are super intelligent, super driven, and have those unrelenting standards, they get a lot done, but sometimes they can't figure out why everyone else can't get as much done as they do. But, you know, you ask the people in Singapore Church, are you glad that John Louis is your leader? They say yes, because they know we've managed to do amazing things because of him. But they're also glad that he has a good team around him that goes and pokes him sometimes, you know, or forces him to take a vacation. Most people don't have to be forced to take a vacation. But people who are like this have to be forced to take a vacation, right? But, you know, this is how it works. So it helps sometimes to think, aha, no wonder so-and-so was like that. It's not because they were mean or whatever. It's they were driven by these schemas. Now, let's see what develops some of these life traps. I have two different clips. The first one is from the movie Aquila and the Bee. That's a misprint. It's not the bees. It sounds like a music group. It's Aquila and the Bee. It's about the spelling bee. And this is a true story about a girl who was brought up in the part of New York where she didn't have many opportunities for a good education. No, sorry, not New York. South Central LA. And her father had passed away. But she was a brilliant speller. And in real life, the girl that plays in this story, the girl went on to win the National Spelling Bee, which in America is a pretty big deal, 200 and something million people, you know, in the whole United States, and every year they have the best speller in the country. So it's pretty cool. It's a pretty big honor for them. Funny enough, many of the top winners in the past 10 years have been Indians. Amen. But it's really funny. But in this show, we'll see one of the, you know, fathers has that unrelenting standards.
What are they doing, Danny?
I don't know. Didn't buy the Scrabble games.
Scrabble? I get 30 seconds for each board. We need one more. Who wants to play?
I will.
And right out of the gate,
Roby scores 32 points with Birch on the double word score. Dylan counters with the needy use of Z, 439 big ones. Polly tests the water with Acorn. And Dylan answers with a body blow beacon for 20. Holy cannoli. Author letters getting 50 extra points for a whopping 82. What was he into? He's fighting the clock. You could cut the tension with a butternut.
Shut
up. Shazam! Dylan gets his own bingo for 76 points. It's come down to this. After having crushed all five opponents, Dylan has only a kilo to beat. But she's ahead by 21 and has only a few letters left. Is this an upset in the making?
My birthday party is this.
Yowza! Using the triple word score, Dylan charges ahead by 6. By 12 points and has only one letter left. But this could be Dylan's final play.
Redemption, sweetheart.
12 points size the game, but Dylan gets Aquila's last 2 points. He wins a heartbreaker. Wow, Aquila. No one ever gets that close to beating Dylan.
But I didn't beat him. Girl, you pass up the mall to play Scrabble. She just got lucky.
If you can barely beat a little black girl at a silly board game, how do you expect to win the national B? Listen! We're not coming in second again this year. We're going to win.
Did you feel that one? Oh, that one kills me. I've seen these clips 1,000 times. I still cry when I watch. It's just so painful because there's so many kids I know that have that situation in their life. That's why we went into counseling in the first place. And I was sharing this at the Hope meeting today. Around the world, they did a survey of children that were 8 to 12 years old. What is the biggest fear in your life? In every country, the answers were the same. My parents dying, myself having no friends, or myself having an illness, or even dying. But guess what? In Singapore, they had a different answer. The number one fear of the 8 to 12 year olds was not passing their exams. And that was actually what motivated John and me to go into counseling in the first place and to teach, thank you, sweetheart, and to teach parenting. I mean, that's why we started taking the parenting class. Because we thought, you know, I mean, you're just basically in, like, producing a pressure cooker state. and how long can that keep up, you know? So it's cool. It's funny because on the one hand, the government puts the pressure on teachers to have a performance and all that. But on the other hand, they start the Ministry of Community Development that actually pays us. Oh, sorry, that's okay. Thank you. That pays us to teach parenting. So I thought, oh, well, never mind. We'll take their money and do it anyway. Now this is a scene. I use this in my self-esteem talk. It's an example of how to not build self-esteem in your kid, obviously. But it has to do with creating that negativity and pessimism and whatever in your child. It's an interesting movie. It's an old movie from the 70s, I think. Maybe 80s, I forgot. Robert Duvall, Blythe Danner. Yeah, just see what you think about this one. The dad is a fighter pilot, but of course there's no war on, so he's home.
Come on.
Out of the game, Jocko. Give up.
Aha.
Stay close, then. Now watch him.
What is that, Ben?
It is I, the great Ventini.
You know, Dad, not one of us has ever beaten you in a single game. Not checkers, not dominoes, not softball, nothing.
Watch it, Ben. He's getting that look.
Come on over here to Daddy Bull. Come
all over.
Get out of here before I knock every freckle off your face.
That's me.
Wasn't that great?
Come on, Jocko. You got to win by two baskets. Instead of one. I changed my mind. Let's go.
Now, you're not going to cheat the boy out of his victory. Come on, be a good sport.
Who the hell asked you anything?
Don't you talk to me like that. No, you won't. Now, he beat you, and it was beautiful.
Lily, you better get in the house before I kick your butt.
It was just beautiful.
No, I mean it. Come on, let's go. Hurry, come on.
Cut that ball.
You better move, woman.
All right.
Come on, let's go. Come on.
He beat me.
Get out of here.
Kind of like winning, huh, Dad?
Get smart with me, Jocko. Kick your butt. Now, come on, guard me. You got to win by two.
Look at the guards, Dad.
Hey,
Mama's boy.
But you're going to cry. Come on, Mama's boy. Let's see you cry. Come on. Squirt it. Come on. Cry. Come on. Cry. Come on. Come on. Just a few. Come on. Squirt a few. Come on. Squirt it. Come on. Cry. Cry. One, two, three. One, two, three. Cry. Come on. Cry. Come on, baby. Come on, little girl. Cry. My favorite daughter, Ben. I swear to God, you're my sweetest little girl. This little girl just whipped your ass good, Colonel.
Isn't that incredible? You can imagine how that might develop a little punitiveness. And your kids. Obviously, depending on the child's personality, they can respond different ways to that, you know. But many kids respond by becoming negative themselves or whatever. Let's go on. So we've been through all the life traps, okay? Go ahead. We've seen all the different ones. so we can remember now what it means, right? We have got old information, and even when we got new information, we couldn't make the switch. And so that's why we have the lifetime. Sorry, keep going. Yeah. So, as I mentioned earlier, with coping, there's different ways to cope. The first way, go ahead, would be surrender or fright, right, where you just give in. Next would be escape or flight, and then counterattack or fight. Punitive, I don't usually talk about because it's kind of similar to counterattack. Then the last one there is healthy adult mode. And that's what I just say as a Christian, that's where we've learned to be like Christ. That's our healthy adult mode talking. When we get angry, don't we often sound like a child? Have you ever fought with a friend or your husband or your mother and afterwards you felt like you sounded like a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old, you know, having a fit? And that's sometimes we say, don't be childish. But that's what they call the angry child mode. But the healthy adult mode, as a Christian, what I believe is that's when we're acting like Christ. Why do we respond like this? Well, temperament kind of decides if you're going to be the counterattacker or the escape person. You know, when I get hurt, I escape. Either by, at times in my past for sure, when I was bulimic, I would binge. I don't do that anymore, many years later, but I still will sometimes eat comfort food. Or maybe, you know, drink a cup of hot chocolate before going to bed, even though I know that's not going to be good for me. I sometimes have, at times when I had tension with John, for instance, we have a double-story house. I don't want to go up to the bedroom and face him because I know we're arguing about something. So I'll stay downstairs and watch TV at midnight, even though it's some pathetic show that I don't want to watch, just to avoid going to the bedroom. You know what I mean? That's escape. Some people will do it by going into fantasy world or virtual world these days, or just reading a lot of books for that matter, traveling, all different ways to do escape mode. Sometimes the counterattack can be, you know how, you ever hurt, you know how sometimes when people are hurt, they get mean? And, you know, if you're able to be lucid and be not run by your emotions, you can tell yourself that, okay, I know he didn't really mean that. I know he's just hurt. But it's sometimes hard to separate the two. Okay, go ahead and look at the next one. Okay, now this is a film that is about, this is a really cool movie about relationships between mother and daughter, relationships between friends. But in this movie, it's about a woman who was an alcoholic. There's so many things to say about this lady. But as an alcoholic, she tried to go off alcohol by taking some drugs, which back in the 60s were approved. I don't think they're approved now. But they made her insane. And she became psychotic. And she attacked her children and sometimes, you know, did some really bad things. So she felt so terrible about that she had, well, in fact, before she even felt bad about it, when she went psychotic, eventually she went catatonic and was put in the institution for 6 months. And then finally when she came out, she was scared to get close to her kids again. Now, growing up, her kids were never told this. She wouldn't let anyone tell this. So she grows up emotionally distant from her children. So her daughter later, although her daughter has many memories of positive childhood, she also has many bad memories too, or confused memories, right? Why was my mother not close to me? That kind of thing. Why did my mother hate me? What's wrong with me? And so she goes and becomes a writer. And that character is played by Sandra Bullock. And she plays a writer who has written a play that's now gotten onto Broadway. So the movie starts where she's getting interviewed by someone from Time Magazine about her play. Well, we all know, as reporters, sometimes, no offense if you're a reporter, but we do know that sometimes journalists tend to twist things a little bit to their own end. And so the article comes out really negative. Like, it just comes out like she said horrible things about her parents, which were exaggerated by the writer of the article. Although she did legitimately say some things about her mom. So her mom is fumingly angry when she reads in Time Magazine her own daughter saying stuff about her childhood. So she gets mad, throws all the daughter's photographs away, and says, I'm never going to speak to you again. They start this fighting back and forth, And then the mom has these really fun friends that she's been close to since she was 7 years old that they call each other the Yaya Sisterhood. And they're now about to be 70 years old. And they decide to go to New York, kidnap the daughter, bring her down to Louisiana, where they're from, and force her to deal with her mother. And the mother's fuming at them, and the daughter's fuming at them, and they don't care. They're going to make them work it out. It's very sweet. And as they do, the daughter has to confront some memories and learn some things about her mom, and the mom has to learn some things. Sorry, it's a bit noisy next door. Hopefully you can hear that. Now, this is her dad.
Hey, Butterbean. Well, look at you. You look pretty good for a hostage.
Yeah, well, my captors are humane. You look like you're holding up pretty well yourself.
Yeah. Well, another fine mess.
Yeah. I think the best lesson I ever learned from you was to lay low. What happened?
Security has been breached. Backups have been called in. Full-scale Yaya alert.
Ah, but the prisoner's been left unattended. You could bust me out.
I could. But then wherever we go, we'd still be there.
I love that line.
No escape.
More like Stockholm Syndrome.
That is you. What about me?
You'll end up as the leader.
The inmate takes over the asylum. What?
Never mind. Never mind. We were ill-equipped. I think it can be summed up in the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
What about the road back? What's that paved with?
Humility.
Really, Daddy? I mean, does she even have that in her repertoire?
Oh, not that she'd care to admit. Pride covers a multitude of sins. But you live with someone long enough, you can see what they're trying to hide by the way they try to hide it. She's hurting too, baby girl.
Daddy, did you get loved enough?
What's enough? My question is, did you? It's never too late.
The next scene is the mother who goes out to pray to Mother Mary. She's Catholic, and she does it at night and doesn't know the husband is spying on her. Watch this.
Mary, mother of the motherless, can you see me? I'm here. It's me again. I need divine intervention once again. Kel Grand Supreme. And here it is. My oldest daughter, Siddeley, the one I've been complaining about, the loudmouth, she may be walking away from true love. Please stop her. Don't let her run away. This is because of me. She never said it, but I know. She's only seen me holding back. I take full responsibility. But I'd appreciate you keeping that to yourself. Please pass this on to your son and his father. I will only smoke once a day. And I'll only have a drink once a week. I mean a day. I'll do the best I can. If you will just help her out with this one thing, I'll make it up to you somehow.
This old house is falling down around my ears.
And so the daughter figures out through all the ways that the friends talk to her, she realizes her mom did love her, but that her mom has her own issues. And the daughter is even able to see ways that she herself made mistakes. Let's see when they finally meet up together. This is her fiancé.
Because there's a lot of people here.
Who she decided not to dump after
stay
the mother's
with
prayer.
Me, though, she's putting in my hands.
Just watch where you're driving.
Janie!
Fiddly walk.
Oh.
Free at last.
Thank God Almighty.
Miss Connor?
Loretta.
Hello.
This is the mother's 70th birthday party.
You know Connor?
Hi, Connor.
Come on, son, come with me. We'll meet the Walker men.
And the clock has stopped just before it reads today.
Mama, that reporter.
What? Truth hurts, kiddo. That's all.
I'm sure I had it coming.
Mama, baby.
There are some things for which I don't expect to be forgiven. Not by my children. Not even by God. There's some things for which it'd be ludicrous to say it. I'm sorry. It'd be so pale.
I just owe you an apology.
No. No, you don't. Don't say it. I've been thinking about what I would say to you should we ever speak again. I went through all of the mean things I could think of to make you feel guilty. You know how I am.
Mm-hmm.
I take a problem and chew on it until all the flavor's gone, and then I stick it in my hair. And then it dawned on me. All those years that I prayed, that I begged on my hands and knees for God to make me more, give me more, make me better, make me stronger. Make me saner. Make all my dreams come true. I finally got an answer.
What?
You. Right there in one person, all I'd ever wanted to be or do. And there you are. You came right through me. And I never even realized. I hate it when it's right in front of your face and you miss it, don't you?
You know, I think in the case of this story, Penny, it's okay, you don't have to turn on. In the case of this story, when she understood her mother's life traps, she could extend grace to her mother by just understanding where her mother came from. Kind of like the story I said last night about the girl that found out her dad had been a slave. And if you see the movie, you'll really... I mean, it's beautiful. It's a fantastic movie. It does have some weird kind of Native American Indian voodoo at the beginning, and I know some people had their conscience hurt last year when I showed that. So if you don't like to watch that, don't get it. But other than that, it's awesome. It's also important that you be aware of your own need for grace. And, you know, one of my favorite verses in the entire New Testament is in Luke chapter 6, where Jesus says, "Give and it shall be given to you, pressed down, shaken together, running over, falling into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. And that is totally in the context of giving grace. I have heard some songs sung in different denominational groups where they use that to teach giving money. And it's a cute song for that. It's not wrong. I sing it like that, and it's a cute song. But it's not about giving money. It's about giving grace, giving forgiveness. And I figure when I go to Judgment Day, I need all the grace I can get. So woe be to me if I don't give it out right now in liberal doses. I don't want there to be any holding back when I face God with grace and forgiveness. So, being aware of our own grace, I think the next clip shows that even better. So this is my last clip of the evening. It's from the movie Click. And maybe you saw this before, I don't know, but it's about a guy who's frustrated with his life. And he's trying to get ahead in life, and he wants to build a great life for his family. He's a nice dad, nice father. But, you know, things just aren't working the way he thinks they should work. Things aren't moving as fast as he thinks they should move. So, on top of that, he's annoyed because every time he tries to turn on the TV, he accidentally switches on the fan or turns on the dryer or something. So he decides the answer in life will be to get one of those universal remotes that runs all your gadgets that would help him. However, when he goes to the store to get the remote, he actually gets a magic device. And when he comes home, it doesn't just mute the TV, it mutes the dog barking. It rewinds when he wants to find out what he did on his first date with his wife so he can surprise her on their anniversary. It rewinds and he gets the memory. Oh, you were wearing a pink sweater. Oh, honey, you're so romantic. You remember what I was wearing. Actually, he didn't, but he rewound it. You know. It fast forwards through life's problems. And that's very handy. Oh, I'm in a hurry. I'll fast forward through my shower. Or I'll fast forward through dinner with my family because I got to go do my work late at night at home. But it also had fuzzy logic, so it got stuck on the preferences. So every time he had a problem, it automatically fast-forwarded. Pretty soon, he unfortunately has fast-forwarded through most of his life. His wife got so fed up that he wasn't ever there emotionally, she divorced him and married the swim instructor. His kids grew up pretty much without him, and his dad died and he didn't even know it. It's very, very sad. He becomes very rich beyond his wildest dreams. But he has nothing. And so this part is where he's just come up kind of out of his fog at the time of his son's wedding. He goes to the wedding and he has a heart attack while he's dancing with his ex-wife. So he then wakes up in the hospital and the mad scientist that sold him the remote in the first place comes and talks to him. We're just going to watch a very tiny bit about that. This is in the year 2026.
One dance? You pop an artery.
Why did you make me waste my entire life?
You were fast-forwarding through your life long before you ever met me. Look at the life you chose, big shot.
That is not the life I wanted.
It is. Looks like it is.
Thank you. So, the reason I like that part is Michael, the character Adam Sandler was playing. Okay, Penny, you can turn left. Michael felt that that guy made him waste his entire life. But that guy said, you were fast-forwarding through your life long before you met me. And what you see if you watch the whole movie is at the very beginning, he had promised his little kids he was going to build a tree house for them, and he got started, and he never finished for several months. And he kept putting things off, and that was before he ever met this other guy, you see? So he said, you were fast-forwarding through your life long before you met me. And he said, but that's not the life I wanted. And he said, well, it's the life you chose. And he said, no, I didn't want that. And then he puts a little DVD finder up there, and he was like, written, produced, and directed by Michael Newman. He was like, yeah, I think it was. See, we have to take responsibility for our choices. And I know for me, when I think about the regrets I have about something, you know, that I've done in my life where I think, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. Number one for me is not taking care of my health. Because I have constantly put that off and not taking care of my health, allowed myself to get overweight, allowed myself to not take care of my psoriasis, it's caused other secondary problems. I have painful feet. I have painful back. I sometimes don't sleep well. I get reflux. All of those are because I didn't take care of my health earlier on. Did I know I was supposed to? Yes. Is it anyone else's fault? No. Now, one of the things that I bought into, you might say, was that idea of the intense work ethic. That if you're a good Christian, you should work. And I highly esteemed that because I knew in my character I didn't have self-control. So I really went after working long hours and whatnot. And I would stay up late and get up early and all that. You know what I'm talking about, right? But I have absolutely zero bad attitude towards anyone for that. You know why? Because just like that guy said, I lived the life I chose. And the other thing that he said that I love was, he said, you were fast-forwarding through your life long before you met me. You know, the truth is, when I was a baby Christian, I was actually one of those unusual people, I suppose, that was converted in the mainline church. I was baptized at 17 years old in Texas in a mainline church situation. It takes too long to tell this whole story, but basically I was converted from a non-Christian family because of the Bible. It is a fun story, but I just don't have time to tell it. So anyway, when I was a young Christian, one of my best friends when I was in the campus ministry the next year was this really fun guy who wanted to be a minister. He was brilliant. He was doing law. He was doing Hebrew and Greek. He was just very smart and very fun. He went on to become one of the most famous lawyers in the United States, even right now. He's very wealthy and famous in America. At the time, though, he was super excited about becoming a minister. And he came up with this theory one day when we were talking about God and whatnot. He said, you know, I worked it out mathematically. If you only sleep 4 hours a day, you can have X amount of more hours of production in helping people become Christians. So I thought, yeah, that's right. So I thought it was fun to try to get as little sleep as possible so I could win as many as possible. I was like this in the traditional church just before I moved to ICOC. I mean, I reached out to everyone in my whole dorm on my floor. I invited every single one of them to Bible talk and studied the Bible with people. So I did not become this way just because of what someone made me. I was like this already. I was attracted to that myself. Probably because it was so opposite of my nature. You know, I thought it was good to aspire to that. And I was the kind of person who loves fellowship. Anybody that knows me knows I never shut up. And so I will stay up in fellowship till 3 in the morning, and it's not a burden to me. I love that. I didn't stop doing that, in fact, until I had children when I was 30. Because once you have kids and they make you wake up at 6, you can't keep staying up till 3 every night. You'll die. But honestly, you know, that was me. So now that I look back and think, man, I sure wish I would have taken care of my health better. I don't blame anyone for that. I look at myself and go, amen, you've had some good years. You better start now before you're 50. Maybe you can still, you know, manage to salvage yourself. I always get inspired when I hear about those people that are like 50 years old and suddenly they started lifting weights or whatever. I think, okay, I got a few years left. I'll make it. I saw a video of this guy called Jack LaLanne, who's a famous weightlifter in America. He's 90 years old and he's still doing it. But I was like completely turned off because he said, anything that tastes good, spit it out. I was like, oh. That's so depressing. Oh, my. Now, how can we put some practicals in this? By the way, I know it's 8:30, but I'm sorry, I still have a little more. So if you need to go and it's 8:30. Oh, good. Thank you. Pretend. It's like 8:27, right? Yeah. So, but I just want to share a few more things if you need to leave. Obviously, it's fine. Leave if you need to. I just want to share maybe another 15, 20 minutes. But that is, how can we start, you know, ourselves having some recovery? How can we, do some practical things? I just wanted to say one thing on that last slide. If small groups are healthy, your church can be healthy. Now, everybody uses different terminology, so I'm going to explain to you what I mean by small group. We do have Bible talks in our church. Our Bible talks meet once a month, and they're for the purpose of bringing your friends along and helping them to study the Bible. But we have small groups that meet after every midweek, and those are all female or all male. It's not mixed. And it is for the purpose of being open and helping each other, being vulnerable together, growing, learning, calling each other higher, whatever you want to call that. I can call it discipling, and I hope you don't get offended. It's not supposed to be in the negative sense. Now, of course, that doesn't mean someone won't sin, but hopefully everyone knows what they're supposed to do, and then someone can correct that person. But basically, the small groups are for that purpose. If we, okay, look at the term there, limited reparenting. So many things, if you just change the vocabulary, it helps you to think about it better. Why do we develop life traps? Because our needs were not met. It doesn't mean our parents necessarily made a mistake, right? It just means they didn't know how to meet that need. Or maybe because of our temperament was a certain way, it was a need they just couldn't meet. So, what do we need more of? We need some reparenting. Now, think about if you were around in the days when you actually did get some good discipling. All right, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I know myself, I had very good discipling at times. Very helpful. I shudder to think, to this day, I shudder to think what I would be like as a person, because in my heart, as I said yesterday, I do have such a high level of confidence that I can be completely insensitive and arrogant and overbearing. So I'm so grateful I had lots of discipling about my arrogance. There may have been times when maybe I got a little bit of harsh discipling about that. I don't know, but you know what? I don't care. Because I needed discipling, and I'm grateful for it. And I know the people that gave it to me did love me. I do believe that, even if they didn't say it perfectly. However, I know there was some bad stuff done too. I'm not condoning that part. But when the discipling was done well, it's exactly the same thing that you get if you pay $200 an hour to a schema therapist and he gives you reparenting. Okay? And he won't be using the Bible. Now, if you do need therapy, I have some name cards of a schema therapist that works in London and can refer you to other schema therapists. So if you feel like you need that, by all means, go for it. And I'm not against it either, especially if you get one that you know won't turn you against God. I am against the therapists who say you don't need God or the church is wrong. I hate those kind of situations, and I would never tell anyone to go to that. But if you, as long as you're going to someone who honors your religion and doesn't, you know, make you go against the Bible, then I'm all for it. But what I want to say is, this is how we use schema therapy in our church. We teach the small group leaders to not be judgmental, but to help each other deal with our life traps. Now, our leaders are not professionals, and they don't make any promises that they are. And we never tell anyone, oh, you're going to get professional help. All we say is, we're going to love each other like the Bible says. We're going to listen to each other. We're going to encourage each other and help each other. And if there's a situation that people feel that they just don't know what to do with, of course they'll come and tell someone else. You know, they'll come and tell John and me or whatever. And so far, it's been extremely positive in our church. And it's just from the mindset of limited reparenting means helping people work through their life traps. And it's a positive kind of discipling. That's all it is. It's very helpful input in one another's lives. I can't help 950 people in my church. It's impossible. But I can help some of them who can help some of them who can help some of them. That is the positive side of discipling. Okay, next slide. So, what about this term? Vulnerability versus openness. Now, in our ICOC, traditionally, we've lifted up the idea of being open. When you got baptized, you were told you had to be open when you studied the Bible. And then when you were a young Christian, you were told you had to be open. And then later, when someone wants to be close to you in relationships, they say, come on, you need to be open. But John and I now take open as a bad word. Because openness can have a double-edged sword. Open can mean, hey, honey, I'm going to be open. And I'm going to tell you what I think about you, and I don't care what you think. Imagine if in 2003, instead of having open forums, imagine if you'd had vulnerability forums. Now, here's what we learned when we studied schema therapy. This is from Jeffrey Young, okay? This guy doesn't believe in God. He's not a Christian in the least, but he's this guy that's pioneered this therapy. He said, you don't talk to people about openness. You talk to your clients about being vulnerable. How does a person respond to get to the healthy adult mode that I mentioned earlier, which we call being Christ-like, okay? He says, first, he calls it the vulnerable child mode. You need to learn to be vulnerable. What does a vulnerable child do? They talk about their weakness. They talk about their feeling. They talk about their need. And they ask for help. I forgot to write ask for help down. And they ask for help. That's what a vulnerable child does. And in the vulnerability state, you assume the best from the person you're talking to. So, for example, let's say, just for the sake of argument, you're in the ministry, in a ministry where the leader has asked you to babysit for 3 nights in a row. But you are taking a course. Now, if you're open, you might say, what kind of leader are you anyway? You don't care about my life. And you feel better. Has that helped your relationship with the leader at all? Has it helped to make you more Christ-like? Has it made them more Christ-like? No, it probably brings out their counterattack mode. You might hear words like proud, weak, whatever, right? Or some other label. None of those things, though, are helpful. What about Ephesians 4:29? Do not let any unwholesome word come out of your mouth, but only that which is useful for the building up of others. That's in the Bible. I think that gets rid of about 90% of our open forums, if you ask me. But that doesn't mean that some of the issues were not correct. But what if we brought them up in a vulnerable way? So the vulnerable person says, I appreciate that you need help with taking care of your children and that you have some important things to do. However, I feel that sometimes you don't consider the schedule that I have. And my weakness is I want to make you happy because I really like you and I esteem you, but I need help in being able to still do the things I need to do for my course, and how can we work on this together? Now imagine the difference in the outcome. And if you've gone to such an extent to be vulnerable and not open, and if the person is still a jerk, then you have evidence to go and do Matthew 18, where you take someone with you, and then you go, and if they don't listen, you really press forward and act on it. But 99% of the time, they will. And they'll go, oh, I'm so sorry. I wasn't considering your situation. Right? Okay? That's vulnerability. Now, here's how it works in a marriage. Just to give you an example. When John and I took the schema course together, it was the week before we went off for our 20th anniversary. It was about a year ago. So can you imagine? Here we are in Bali, Indonesia, enjoying a beautiful hotel resort, and we're talking about our schemas. We're sitting by the swimming pool talking about our life traps. Oh, I think I have defectiveness. What about you? But anyway. It was a blast, though. Honestly, we had a total, total blast. It was great. That's one of the nice things about Singapore. You live an hour from Bali. Wow. Yes, there are some perks. Amen. But anyway, no, it was cool. It was our 20th anniversary. And it was really special. But we thought about all the times we fought with this counterattack, or him counterattacking and me escaping, or whatever. Or him escaping and into his work. John becomes a workaholic when he goes into escape mode. So we thought about, how about if we just learn to say it in the vulnerable way? Easier said than done. Because when those emotions are in, it actually shuts down your brain. So if you ask me in class with a professor, to come up with how to say it in the vulnerable mood. Oh, I'm good at that. Because I don't have an attitude towards the professor. But in the middle of a flaming argument with my husband, full of passion. Now me, I'll keep my mouth shut, because I don't want to sin usually, not all the time, sometimes I sin. But usually I'll keep my mouth shut, but I remember one day it took me a whole day to figure out how to say it in the vulnerable mode. I just couldn't say it, I couldn't, because I was so mad. It took me 24 hours. Finally, I got it, and I wrote it down, and I went and said it to him. Seriously. And one day, when we had some argument about something, I forgot what, and he said something to me, because he was angry, so he said something hurtful. I, instead of reacting or feeling hurt myself, I tried to listen in the third person, and I said, aha, let's try to say that again in the vulnerable mode. I'm lucky he didn't pick up a hammer and hit me. We used to live in an apartment on the 10th floor, because most people in Singapore live in, you know, apartment buildings. We used to live on the 10th floor, and on those days, sometimes I would rate my marriage was how much on a scale of 0 to 10 did I want to throw him off the balcony. Praise God, we moved into the ground floor now. But anyway, so the day that I told him about, you know, honey, why don't you try to say that in the vulnerable mode? Anyway, he managed to not, you know, punch me or something. And then he was having a hard time saying it in the vulnerable mode. And I said, that's okay, I'll coach you. So we just finished the course together, right? What did two psychologists do, you know, when they fight? So we're sitting there, and so I literally said to him how he should say it to me in the vulnerable mode. And because he was cooperative, right, and we were, you know, it was good because we obviously just did the course together. And so then he was like, yeah, that's what I meant. But, when I heard it, even though I said it, it still was able to melt my heart. Because when you hear the vulnerable thing, you just go. So for instance, let's say a wife says something that the husband feels, makes the husband feel disrespected. Okay? Common situation. The husband generally goes, I hate it when you're disrespectful! He's being open. But that doesn't usually help. I wasn't being disrespectful. What's wrong with you? That's your problem. So, but how about if the husband says, let's say the husband has lost his job, and you say, you know, I notice you haven't looked at the newspaper today again, or something like that, right? Which is the kind of thing a wife might say in that situation. So the husband, instead of going, you know, off the rails and freaking out, which is how he would feel, what if he says it in a vulnerable way? What if he says, you know, I already feel bad about myself right now, and I feel so weak, I actually need you to help me not feel bad about myself. So when we talk about my job, can you try to say it in a way that doesn't make me feel worse about myself, but encourages me? Don't you think any wife would say, oh, I'm so sorry?
Yeah.
You'd feel terrible when you said it like that. And you instantly feel closer. You don't feel alienated. You don't have a counter-attacking a fight. You get what I'm saying? That's the beauty of vulnerability. So tonight, you probably won't have any energy to think about it. But maybe tomorrow, set aside a few minutes in the day to try to think about some vulnerable phrases you could learn to say. All right, let's go. Now, this is something that I learned when I was in university. And some of you that have studied any kind of psychological stuff, you would have seen this before, right? So, I don't know. I didn't take psychology, so I don't actually know where I learned this. I think I may have seen it in a Christian book. Because I used to read a lot of Christian books, obviously, in university. The Johari Window helps us to have self-awareness. Okay? So let's go to the first slide. So everything on this side is what I see about myself. This is what I don't see about myself. Okay? Go ahead, sir. Everything above this line is what others see in me. And everything down here is what others don't see in me. Okay? So, this is what I see and what others see. So this is the public face. This is what I allow you to see on purpose, my public face. Over here is what I don't see at all, but you all can see right in clear day. That's called your blind spots. Right? We talk about having blind spots. This one here is what others don't see, but what I know. These are my secrets. And then right here, you don't know it and I don't know it. I call this one only God knows. Okay? Next slide. Now, if you don't allow people to see much about yourself, if you're not very vulnerable, and if people around you don't feel free to tell you the truth about yourself, guess what? Look at which part is the largest. The unknown is the largest. How do you get more self-awareness? Next slide, please. When you are very vulnerable, and when you allow people in your life to tell you the truth about yourself, obviously, safe people that are telling you the truth in love, amen. Then your blind spots shrink. Obviously, this is shrunk because you're sharing your life. And the unknown is very small. Isn't that cool? That's how I've operated my whole life. When I first got married, John heard me on the phone with my discipler. I was in Singapore. My discipler was in England. I was on the phone, and he walked in. And after he walked out, and he was like, "That was sick." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "You're so open, you're too open." Part of that is a man-woman thing. But honestly, he has since said, and now that he's doing schema therapy, he has a supervisor he has to talk to every week for an hour. And he said, "My wife is the person who taught me how to be open in the vulnerable sense." Okay, next slide. So what I just showed you is what discipling is supposed to be. Okay, so forget your, if you have negative memories about it, just go and throw those in the reject garbage pile. We don't want those anymore. I'm talking about the positive way, the biblical way. Small groups full of vulnerable and safe people can draw out one another's life traps, listen and help, disciple, lead to Christ, and support one another. Proverbs 20, verse 5, "The purposes of a man's heart are deep waters, but a man of understanding draws them out." Amen. Matthew 12, 20, "This is how Jesus looks at us when we are weak. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out." And Psalm 107:20, our theme verse for yesterday, "He sent forth his word and healed them. He rescued them from the grave." Now, last but not least, I know it's a long night, but I just wanted to close with this. Some of us are our own worst enemy, right? And we have a very hard time appreciating ourselves. So I'm going to give you some affirmation exercises. And hopefully, as you reframe, like in those movies we saw at the end, and learn to forgive and learn to look at things from a different perspective and not blame others and take responsibility, etc., etc., at the same time, hopefully you'll learn to love yourself and affirm yourself. And this is not some instant thing you're going to learn in one night, but I just want to give you some ideas for what you can do in the future. So, a visualization exercise is for you to get in a place where you're comfortable, where you can sit down and you're comfortable. You can relax. You can either close your eyes or leave your eyes open, depending on how you feel. And if you want to right now, you can even do this right now while we're talking. But imagine being in a small performance hall, maybe similar to the one next door where we sometimes have church. And there's a stage in there. Now, look on the stage and think about how all the lights in that whole hall are focused on the stage. So can you visualize something like that? You walk into a place and there's lights coming down on the stage, right? Now, put yourself on the stage. with all the lights on you and visualize good things happening to yourself. Tell yourself that the abundance of God is available to everyone, including you. One writer figures that we should say, "I approve of myself," 400 times a day. Now, I don't know that we need to do it 400 times. That might be a bit overkill. But the point is, we need to remember that we can approve of ourselves. Why? Not because of whatever the world says, but because God approves of us.
Amen.
One great error that many of us as Christians make, as I mentioned last night when reading the Bible, is we focus on the negative. We focus on what we need to repent of and change and what's wrong with ourselves and how we're not good enough. And sometimes there's a place for that. But not every time. It feels weird to affirm yourself. But actually, it's what God does. God affirms us. He says, "You're my treasured possession. You're the apple of my eye." So, if He does it, why shouldn't we do it? One great lie of the world is, "I'm not good enough." So then we can't enjoy life because we have that wrongly held belief. We need to substitute negative messages that have carried over either from our childhood or maybe having a roommate or a boss that was negative or a teacher or whatever. And instead, think of phrases while you're standing on that stage. Think of things like, "I trust God to bring me my highest good. I am in the process of making positive changes. I experience love wherever I go. I appreciate all that I do." And saying to yourself, perhaps looking in the mirror, "You are good enough and you are deeply loved." Now those are, they, maybe it sounds simple, but they're very, very effective and make you feel great. One of my friends said that she looks in the mirror. I wrote this down because I thought this was so cool. She said she looks in the mirror every day and says, "Susie, you are wonderful and I love you. This is one of the best days of your life. God is working everything out for your highest good. Whatever you need to know is revealed to you. Whatever you need will come to you. And all is well in your world." How encouraging. Now, in just the same way, not only do we need to affirm and love ourselves, but in terms of forgiving people, we also need to learn to do that. Sometimes, right? And I think there's people who have had struggles with forgiveness because they think, "That guy hurt me, and I've been suffering for 12 years, and then he's going to say sorry, and it's all finished. You've got to be kidding!" But remember that verse in Luke. "Give, and it shall be given to you." That's right. 77 times 7. That's right. That's what Jesus said. And it's not fun sometimes, and it's not easy, but we all need forgiveness. So if you can think about going back to that stage, right, that we were on with the light shining on us and we were affirming ourselves, now how about substituting it and putting a person on the stage that you feel resentful towards? I'm not going to ask you to do that now. You need to do this in the privacy of your own home. But if you're going to tell yourself that the abundance of God is available to everyone, that also includes the person who has hurt you. So you might try saying something like, "I forgive you for not being the way I wanted you to be. I forgive you and I set you free." You know, I know with my dad, he's the person I've had the hardest time forgiving in my life. And my dad's a nice person. But, you know, I just was disappointed about certain things. He didn't meet my emotional needs, blah, blah, blah. I didn't have a bad life. I feel guilty even saying I had issues with my dad. But he can be a bit of an overbearing, you know. You know what I mean, what dads are like. He's always right and we're always wrong, if you know what I mean. That kind of thing. So sometimes I would get ticked off about that. And I'd have these feelings like, why is he like that? Or he'd rebuke me about how I did this or how I did that. Or, and, you know, in the kingdom crisis even, he was like, "I told you so," you know, always rubbing it in my face kind of thing. So I had some attitude towards him about one night he really rebuked me about some stuff about money, and he had, like, completely made it all up. It wasn't even what happened at all. It was like, I said, Dad, you're rewriting history here. He said, well, that's not how I remember it. But, with his Texas accent. But I was fuming. I was so mad. I was with my parents on a little holiday. What a holiday. I went in the bathroom, locked myself in the hotel bathroom, and wrote in my journal for 3 hours in anger, crying. I was so mad at him. I was like, I can't believe he's ruining this holiday because he's so determined to try to prove to me something that didn't even happen. You know, I was like so mad. And I was like, really steamed. And it, like for 2 years I kept thinking, because I'm a little bit too subjugated to go and confront him that day, but I kept thinking for 2 years that I'm going to have to go and confront this guy somehow. I was like so ticked off. And well, anyway, I read this book then about talking to people who are over 65 or people that have retired already and how their agenda in life changes. And part of what they care about is what legacy they're leaving behind. And they might not even know they care about it, but they do. And as I got to thinking about that with my dad, I thought, you know, my dad is so good with money and finances, he's actually petrified that I haven't learned anything from him. Because I don't make any money, I just spend money. You know, I've never had a job where I made money in my life. And I know that's what he's worried about. When he dies, what's going to happen to me? So actually, the things he said, even though they were nasty and they hurt, but it was totally out of love and fear and concern that he said it. You know, as soon as I got that, all my anger just melted away. I didn't have any need to go and confront him about anything. And I wrote him a very sweet letter telling him how much I loved him and how grateful I was for the next Father's Day. So I think, you know what I'm saying about this reframing thing? We can learn to let go of stuff when we just sometimes put it in a different frame. Last but not least, yesterday I shared about that sister. You know, I quoted some of the stuff she wrote to me. She also wrote this in a different email, and I just thought this was a neat idea about learning to reframe. I mean, here's someone who'd been negative for so long, for so many years. Like I said yesterday, she was ready to say, I don't even know how I can be saved or how I can save my children. You're my last hope. She was totally, totally in depression, very miserable as a Christian. Anyway, after she had the miscarriage, a few weeks later, she wrote me this. She said, just 2 days ago, we found out that my daughter has chicken pox, and she has to stay home from preschool till next Thursday. I began to think, maybe that's why God allowed me to lose the baby. Otherwise, it would have been dangerous for me and the baby to be exposed to that virus. And, you know, it was like, not that that, I mean, who knows? Only God would know why she had the miscarriage. But it was like, for the first time, she could learn to not be angry about things. But then she could say, oh, maybe there was a higher reason for that. And she's the one that I told you miraculously, you know, 7 months later got pregnant without the IVF and all that. So I think for us, if we can learn to talk about things in a vulnerable way. Now, you've got to agree. If you're going to be in a small group, you have to have an agreement first. Hey, guys, is this going to be a safe group? Are we going to love each other and be kind to each other and be truthful? Are we going to be vulnerable and not open? Right? You know the difference? Sometimes you can say, sister, I think you're being a little too open. Let's be vulnerable. Okay? Right? Amen. That's what we can say to each other in love. And we can, you know, if we're safe, we're going to be confidential. We don't go out and tell everyone what people in our group said. Okay? It's a safe group. It's a confidential group. But when we have those kind of small groups, with that, we can start doing that reparenting with one another, that helpful discipling, calling each other to be like Jesus, healing ourselves spiritually. And guess what the beauty is? When we get healed spiritually, we can feel God. Our hearts are soft to be able to feel God. And when we're like that, is it difficult to share your faith? Is it difficult to bring people to God? No, because it's so much a part of you. It overflows from you. And you'll just see your whole church literally will start lighting up with this kind of brightness. You know, one of the funny benefits of teaching this schema stuff at church is now everyone in our church uses all this funny schema language. So I'll just close out with this story. But one day recently there was a brother. We have these things called the poor contribution talk. Do you have that? Yeah. So anyway, the guy was doing the poor contribution talk. And he was like, now depending on your schema, you'll think different thoughts when that bag goes by. If you have mistrust and abuse, you might be thinking, I wonder what they do with the money. He said, if you have subjugation, you might be thinking, well, I better give, otherwise I may get in trouble. If you have self-sacrifice, you'll think, oh, I didn't need to eat anyway. If you have entitlement, you might say, let the other guy give. If you have insufficient self-control, you go, oh no, I didn't bring my wallet. So everybody in the whole room was dying laughing. This is just some like Bible talk leader, you know. We were just all sitting there hysterically laughing. And of course, I'm sure the visitors in the room were like, what kind of a weird church is this? But it's really united our church in a fun way and helped people, I think, to give each other a lot more grace, to feel like, amen, we're all going to accept each other and love each other. We're going to help each other get to heaven. And we're going to hopefully bring other people along with us. So God bless you in your search for spiritual healing. Amen.